Please don't come close to me.
Sir, I'm asking you to stop recording.
Please don't come close to me.
Please take your phone off.
Please don't come close to me.
And I'm taking pictures and calling the cops.
Please call the cops. Please call the cops.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
Please tell them whatever you like.
Excuse me? I'm sorry, I'm in the ramble, and there is a man, African-American, who is a fight pilot. He's recording me and threatening me and my dog. There is an African-American man, I am in Purple Park. He's recording me and threatening myself and my dog. I'm sorry, I can't hear you either. I'm being threatened by a man in the ramble. Please send the cops immediately.
Thank you.
This video reminds me of Douglas County, Nebraska, court case TR18915 and prosecutor Mary Ellenston and a Judge Hendrick. This video reminds me of Douglas County District Court case CI18-9530. And an attorney named Matthew P. Sathoff, who owns the Sathoff Law Firm at 440 Regency Parkway in Omaha, Nebraska. Sadly, but true, this video also reminds me of the 1921 Tulsa, Oklahoma race massacre, where around 300 black people lost their lives because of a flat-out white lie. Eventually, I will get around to explaining Douglas County, Nebraska case number TR18915 and prosecutor Mary Ellenston's role in this case. But for now, I'm going to address Douglas County District Court case CI18-9530 and the role that Matthew P. Sathoff is playing in this case here and now. And just so you know, this case, CI18-9530, has been heard before the Nebraska Supreme Court. That's right, the highest court in the land. And it can be searched online under Humphrey v. Smith, Humphrey versus Smith. In the video you've just watched, Amy Cooper is found practicing what's called demonization. And just as you just witnessed in America's courtrooms, for centuries now, attorneys and prosecutors have used different methods of demonization to win cases and to imprison black people all across this country. In the video you've just heard or watched, the black man's name is Christian Cooper. I mean, although the woman with the dog is Amy Cooper, other than the video, Amy and Christian share no connection. But this shared video is proving to the world, the entire world, just how easy it is for racist white people to demonize black people in America. The two people in this video, which you never can see Christian, but they were involved in a situation in Central Park. At all times, Central Park requires that all dog owners keep their pets on a leash. But on this particular date of this recording, this black man, Christian Cooper, had only been out bird watching in the park. And that's when Christian Cooper came upon Amy Cooper, the white woman in the video. As seen in the video, her dog is not on a leash. Most dog owners anywhere in the world believe that their dogs want to attack or bite another person. And after every vicious dog attack involving their dogs, they'll say this. And this is whether it's been another person or a pet. We often hear the aggressive dog's owner say, "My dog or dogs have never shown signs of aggression before." Well, yeah, but by then it's too late. A person or another pet would have already been attacked and bitten. So with the two Coopers encounter in Central Park, out of fear of the dog, Mr. Cooper stopped in his tracks and simply reminded Amy Cooper about the park's rules on unleashed dogs. Thankfully, too, common sense had caused Christian to videotape their encounter. And all of this happened because Mr. Cooper had calmly reminded Miss Cooper that her dog was supposed to be on a leash. And what Amy Cooper did next is what's known as demonization. Without being threatened in any way, in any manner, Amy Cooper very calmly stated to Christian Cooper, a complete stranger, that she was going to call the police and tell the police that a black man was threatening her and her dog. Luckily, this man already had the videotape rolling. It turned out, too, that just like she said, Amy Cooper's threat had not been an empty threat. She'd actually called the police and put on a performance meant for the entire world to witness. And without this video, if the police had shown up and Mr. Cooper hadn't videotaped this incident, most likely the cops would have shot and killed this black man all over a flat-out white woman's life. So thank you, Christian, for sharing your video with the entire world. People, my thanks are coming from my heart, and it's from my own experiences in Omaha, Nebraska. And I've learned that demonizing black people is nothing new. It's been happening for centuries. And even today, I myself have found myself the victim of these racist actions simply because of the color of my skin. And believe this or not, but every year, the city of Omaha plays host to the College World Series, as well as hosting other major sporting events. But there's a dark side to this place, a shadowy stench fogged amongst the mist, disguised as human beings, but hiding behind every grinning, smiley face you meet. State-sponsored racism resides in this dark place, and it appears to be entrenched in every practice and everything or every entity in this state, a downright nastiness. Folks, cemented evidence shows that Nebraska has a problem in its courthouses, in its courtrooms, with segregation. For those of you viewing this podcast on video, I'd like to ask that you stare at this logo for Hound Dog News for a moment. Because it's true, when African Americans take a step inside of the Douglas County District Courthouse in Omaha, Nebraska, they're actually taking a step into the histories of the past. We've been there and we've already done that. And on the inside of this courthouse, we are still experiencing the halls of segregation. Looking into the faces of injustice. My handle is Snipper, and I'm your host for Hound Dog News. I'd like to thank you before welcoming you to this first episode of Hound Dog News. I'm hoping that all of you listening to me are watching on video, because I've set up some attachments from the plaintiff's May 29th deposition that I want you to take a look at. It's like I say, millions of people around the world use their hands to talk or when they're talking. Okay? The deaf use their hand to speak. Okay? You cannot speak. No one can. Just standing like a stone statue and talking. When you talk, you use your hand. But Matthew Sadoff wanted it on the record that I was using my hands to point at him in an aggressive way. It's like I say, this is what white attorneys do to show the court in a negative view, or show the court a negative view of the black person standing before the judge. And prosecutors do the identical same thing. When you step inside the doorway of the Douglas County District Court in Omaha, Nebraska, I don't care who you are. If your skin color is the wrong color, the judge is willing to consider your skin color over the matter itself, over the content of the case, over the facts of the case. A black person can drive up to that courthouse in a 20-door limousine, in a tuxedo fit for a king. But when he get out of that limousine and he step inside of that courthouse and he step inside of that courtroom, I don't care what he's wearing, that judge only sees what's beneath that tuxedo. And that's the skin color. And any attorney and any prosecutor that's demonized you if you're black, it's gonna win. They're gonna win the case. It's simple as that. That's the way this courthouse is set up. Now, the content from the deposition that I'm about to share with you was taken under oath from the plaintiff, Barbara J. Humphrey, on May 29, 2020. Upon the plaintiffs first filing their lawsuit against my girlfriend, Dora Proslow, and I in 2018, we'd move forward with hiring a law firm from the Omaha, Nebraska area, Abraham Caslow and Casman LLP, located at 87th and Dodge Road. We'd hired attorney Nicole Sigmangelic, who I believe is a partner in this firm, and her assistant, Kevin O'Keefe, to represent the two of us in this matter. By the time that this deposition was taken, it had appeared to Dora and I that Nicole and Kevin had actually been sabotaging our case and working with the opposing parties. So later in this first episode of Hound Dog News, I'm going to attempt to offer a small example of what I perceive as evidence of proof of sabotaging. Anyway, the bottom line is that in the end, I had ended up having to take Ms. Humphrey's deposition myself. So the content that I'm about to share with you comes from my questioning Ms. Humphrey under oath. As I questioned Ms. Humphrey, it appeared that every time Ms. Humphrey was about to reveal information of relevance, her attorney, Matthew P. Sadoff, would interrupt my questioning. And as I'd only had a two-hour window to complete my questioning, over and over and over again, Matthew Sadoff had interrupted and used his own nonsense arguments to burn out the clock. However, putting all of that aside, I'm presenting the documents being shown with one sole purpose in mind. I want to give you, as my audience, an opportunity to question for yourselves whether the language that I'm using in my exchanges with this so-called attorney had been aggressive in any way or manner. Using the documents before you, this is how the verbal exchanges between the three of us had gone. Now, on page 26, under line 12, you'll find me instructing Barbara to look at the next three pages. But before I could actually complete asking Barb to do whatever I wanted her to do, Matthew Sadoff interrupted to say, "Well, you didn't answer the question, so I need to clear up the record because it's not clear." Then I said, "You're not allowing her to answer them." Then he turned around argumentatively and said, "Sir, she doesn't know who drafted these documents. I'm assuming these are your schedules. Is that correct?" When he said that, Line 19 showing me saying, well, guess what, Matt? If she doesn't know, how were they able to create that first page? They said that those were my creations. You said that it was my creation. Now, in an aggressive manner, line 22 finds Matt Sadbelt interrupting me to say, I'll ask you not to point at me. What kind of crap is that, folks? But anyway, line 23 finds me apologizing. I apologize, I said. Then he continued, I take that as a threat, and I'll ask the records to reflect that you, before he could finish, he was so aggressive, the court reporter had to yell stop in order to cut him off. Then he continued on page 27 with, the record will reflect that you pointed me, and I take that as a threat in an aggressive manner. Oh my God, people. Which one of us do you think had been the aggressor? I mean, here's a guy who considers himself as an attorney, someone who I personally view as a whiner, saying, record will reflect that you pointed me. Well, boo-hoo-hoo, Matthew Satoff, and take your thumb out of your mouth while you're at it. And just to make certain, folks, of my analysis, I'd search the meaning of whiner online. A whiner is someone who complains a lot, someone used to get in their own way, self-pitying in a manner or tone. Being a whiner makes you look petty, childish, unworthy. The record will show that you pointed at me, he assured me. Man, oh man, oh man. When Matthew Sadoff said that, it'd been so childish that I could have dropped to the floor. But as I'm sitting here writing, I can reflect on another record, since he wanted to play by the record. On March 3rd of 2021, this case was heard before the Nebraska Supreme Court. And even before the Supreme Court justices had finished listening to the arguments, in my perception, this attorney showed signs of a two-year-old. So go online and search Humphrey V. Smith, and you'll also find a downloadable audio in this case. This audio is 21 minutes and 47 seconds long. Click on this and listen to the last 4 minutes of this audio. You'll hear Matthew Sadoff making his strongest pitch to the justices. But after realizing that his strongest pitch wasn't going to change the outcome, not unsuspected, you'll hear Matthew Sadoff say, I've been here before and lost. After what had happened at Ms. Humphrey's deposition, here, I couldn't laugh at him. I sat stunned, blown away by what I'd heard on that audio, and left wondering, are you kidding me? I've refrained myself from using the word kid outside of kidding. But the targeted point in Ms. Humphrey's deposition had been at the finger-pointing point and who'd been the aggressor. Eventually, I'll present further evidence showing Matthew Sadoff's use of demonization against me in this case, including one instance where he'd done this in the courtroom and before the presiding Judge Doherty on July 16th, 2020. It's called demonization, folks. Amy Cooper understood the power of these actions against African Americans. Court prosecutors understand the power of these actions against African Americans. And in my current Douglas County District Court case, CI 18-9530, Matthew P. Sadoff understands the power of portraying me as some kind of a black demon. So will Judge Doherty use his ears for listening and rule on the facts in this case, or would Judge Doherty rely upon the person standing out front of his eyes and allow a plaintiff's fraudulent claims and possible attorney's aiding to go unpunished? Matthew Sattal is using the documents you see before you and other deceptive practices to demonize me, because this is the only way that he'll ever have a chance of winning case number CI-18-9530. If the real evidence is presented and considered by Judge Doherty, then there is absolutely no doubt that Matthew Sattal will be held accountable for perjury, misrepresenting facts, fabricating evidence, and much more. The evidence is documented in legal submissions and court records, and these legal documents speak for themselves. Matthew Sattal is not fighting to win a client's case. Matthew Sattal is fighting to save his own ass, and using demonization tactics is the only distractive way that Matthew Sattal has his own at his disposal. His clients filed a frivolous lawsuit, and from its beginning, it appears that both the plaintiff's attorneys, Matthew Sattal and John Chatelain, have aided in a crime of fraud as they've deceived the court. For those of you watching this podcast on video, you can see a copy of what they call an amortization schedule. Simply put, it is a payment schedule. And for those of you that's not watching on video, hear my voice. Forgery is a crime. And altering a document for legal use is called a crime if it's someone else's work. You can alter a check. Someone can write you a check. You can change information on that check. It doesn't matter if the name on there is correct. It doesn't matter if the address on there is correct. The payment amount, any altering at all that the original or the person that that check belonged to didn't write or didn't do, is called forgery. People, I'm involved in a lawsuit. 7 years ago, I created some documents and gave them to a gentleman that was a friend of mine, or supposed to have been, and neither of us ever used them. So we tossed them aside. In 2018, the gentleman died. His daughter took the old documents that I had left there at his house, altered those documents, and created a new amortization schedule, which was then used as the basis and foundation for it. Actually, my girlfriend and I both are victims and the defendants in this case. And what the plaintiff's attorney, Matthew Sattal, doesn't know is that I managed to get my hands on a copy of that altered amortization schedule, along with material that would prove that the plaintiff's daughter created the fraudulent schedule. Even though, when the plaintiff's attorney, Matthew Sattal, filed his motion for summary judgment with the Douglas County District Court, Mr. Sattal had continuously claimed that it had been me who created the fraudulent document. At the same time, when Matthew Sattal filed the brief for the appellee, Barbara J. Humphrey, with the appellant court, which was heard by the Supreme Court, he had made these same claims, even though he'd known that it had been his client's daughter who created this document. So I want to play for you a tape recording that recorded the conversations between Kevin O'Keefe and myself. Now, Kevin O'Keefe is an attorney, and at that time, he was employed by the Abrahams, Caslow, and Casman law firm located on 87th and Dodge Road in Omaha, Nebraska. Now, Kevin O'Keefe was the assistant for Nicole Segmangeli. Now, I think Nicole is a partner in this law firm. And while they were supposed to have been working for me, evidence showed that they was doing things that sabotaged my case. So I want to play the tape recording and allow you to hear with your own ears what Kevin O'Keefe had said about Matthew Sathoff informing him that the daughter had created this schedule. And I had already told Kevin or mentioned to him that Matthew Sathoff was going to attempt to say that it had been me created this document, that created this document, and I had been correct about that. And so his reason for doing this, or should say my reason for informing Kevin of that, because I feel like it was going to be that Matt was going to try to use this argument that I created to tape as a way to manipulate and deceive the court. So anyway, here's the tape.
Hello?
Hey, it's Kevin O'Keefe.
How you doing, Kevin?
Good. So, I got to pick my kids up at daycare, but I wanted to call you while it was fresh. So I just got off the phone with Barb's counsel.
Okay.
So we hashed out what the confusion is. Okay. Are you by your computer at all?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna send you what he sent me.
Okay.
So what you'll see there is the line is the Section 1 loan repayment schedule and agreement that you made and dropped off at their house.
At whose house?
Don's house.
When was that done?
Back when you said you had that meeting.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so that's the schedule that they're talking about in their interrogatory, that the one that you made. And you see your name, Ed Smith, is on the top of it if you open it, okay?
That's not the one that I'm looking at in that, the deal that they're sending to the court.
The counsel told me that the daughter made the schedule that you are talking about. The schedule that says amount received as of October 5th of 2018. The daughter made that specifically, exactly as I thought. The daughter made that because she just wanted to calculate the amount that was left on the loan. Okay? So they're not claiming at all that is somehow something that you made.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you heard that with your own two ears. Kevin O'Keefe informed me that the plaintiff's attorneys informed him and his co-worker, Nicole Segmangeli. He's telling me that the plaintiff's attorneys informed them that the daughter, their client's daughter, created that amortization schedule, and that they were not claiming that I created the document, even though they were claiming that. So as this goes on, as I move forward, just listen very closely. Now, I'm going to share with you an email exchange between the gentleman that you just got to listening to, Kevin O'Keefe, and the plaintiff's attorney, Matthew P. Sathoff. Here we go. Okay, now I'll say this again. For those of you who are watching on video, you are able to see this document. Well, it's the email. And for those of you that just listening on your iPhones or whatever, I'm going to read it to you. Now, this is an email between Kevin O'Keefe, the gentleman you just listened to on the recording, and Matthew P. Sathoff. He owns the Sathoff Law Firm at 440 Regency Parkway in Omaha, Nebraska. Now, this email was from Kevin to Matt Sathoff and is dated for August 21st, 2019. And it reads, this is Kevin talking to Matt. Kevin says, I know you didn't prepare the discovery responses. I'm still trying to talk my client off his range. Section 1 of this attached was not in your discovery documents. Instead, the amortization schedule your client made, that's the key word, your client made, was attached. My client is under the impression that this is a scheme to pass off the amortization schedule dated for 10/5/2018 as a document he made in an effort to deceive the court. People, Kevin was correct, and this is exactly what Mr. Sathoff did. He continued to tell the courts he used the phrase he prepared, stating that I prepared the document, even though he had known that his client's daughter had made this document. So, once I got my hands on a copy of this amortization schedule, the altered one, I had taken it downtown to the Omaha Police Department on 15th and Howard and filed it as an incident report. So yes, people, this case is real. And I'm slow about getting it started because I want you to understand what's happening here, how the attorneys in this case has lied all the way through from beginning, and it's not even the end yet. But like I say, I believe that I'm being heard in a segregated courtroom, and I know that I'm being heard in a segregated courthouse. But if you want to research this case, if you want to go see what's going on, you can find it in the Douglas County District Court records as case number CI-18-9530. And if you go online and search Humphrey, H-U-M-P-H-R-E-Y, V. Smith, you will see everything that the Supreme Court had to say about this case. The damage that the district court did to my case, the Supreme Court reversed it and sent it back. Now, Jim Crow laws, or I should say black code laws, restrict evidence from blacks from being admitted in the court. And that's what's happening here now. And that's why that I've started this podcast, to make sure that the public knows what's going on. I know for a fact that Jim Crow laws are being practiced in my case, okay? But by me not being able to testify in my own case until I'm having to bring it public. So we'll go from there. Okay, people. So it's like I say, in order for me to make my case to you, I would need to be able to show evidence of fraud, okay? I want to be able to show evidence that these people have lied to not just the district court, but also the Nebraska Supreme Court. So now, I've already played you Kevin O'Keefe's tape where he's telling me that the daughter created the amortization schedule. I've shown you an email exchange between him and the plaintiff's attorney, Matthew P. Sathoff. Now, I'm going to, if you're looking at it on video, there's a page there, page 27. It's from the plaintiff's May 29, 2020 deposition. Now, on page 27, I've highlighted in orange the things that I'm saying, the questions that I'm asking. In green, whenever the Matthew Sathoff, the attorney, interrupts, and then in pink, what the plaintiff is saying. Okay, now I'm questioning her again, so we're revisiting that amortization schedule. On page 27, on the line 10, I said, the question is, who created page number 7, number 1? Now, I'm referring to the amortization schedule. Then the attorney goes, you never asked that question. Then I say, I'm asking it now. So, who created it, Barb? Barb is the plaintiff's name. Who created it, Barb? I asked it a little bit earlier, and you cut her off. I was talking to the attorney. So then Barb said, I don't know. And then I said, well, how did your attorney get it? Barb, I didn't pay much attention to these amortization schedules because I didn't use them. Okay, so we move on to page 28 from that same deposition. Now, I need to make a correction. The attorney, Matthew Sathoff, I didn't highlight what he was saying in green. I highlighted it in blue. So back to the main issue. Number one, on page 28, under line one, I said, please answer my first question. I was talking to Barb. How did your attorney get the first page? Number three, Barb, I don't know. Me. Who created that first page? Barb, I don't know. It wasn't me. Me. Your attorney sent that to my ex-attorneys, my former attorneys. Why did he do that? Barb, I continued under line 14. I want to know, Miss Humphrey, who created that document? Matt, the attorney, ask and answer. That was his little deal. So then Barb says, yeah, I already answered that. So she was looking for any interruptions by him to rescue her. So then I go on to go, does it look similar, the remainder of the documents behind that first page? Barb, these are different. Thank you, I said. Then Barb, they're different. I mean, it could have been on somebody else's computer. I don't know. I didn't create it. I don't know. Why? Okay, moving on to page 30 from the deposition. Me, under line three. Do you believe, not the first page, but the remainder of the pages in that, do you believe those were created by me? Barb, I don't know who created these. It wasn't me. It wasn't done. I would imagine it had to be you then. But I didn't pay much attention. I didn't pay any attention to these, Edward. Me, I don't want to hear that. Barb, well, I'm telling you, I didn't pay attention to these. Me, yet you entered them into evidence. Barb, well, it was part of your program. For your amortization schedule. So, hey, me, did you enter all of these pages? Barb, I don't remember. Me, every page is there other than the police report, which is the last page. Did you enter all of those pages into evidence with your attorney, Matthew Sathoff, Foreman Foundation? Me, would you like to answer that? Matthew Sathoff, if you know, you can answer it. Barb, this one doesn't look familiar to me. This particular page indicated, she was indicating the page. So I don't know, she said. So we're moving on to page 57 of the deposition. And this time, Ms. Humphrey's attorney, Matthew Sathoff, is the one asking her the question as she's under cross-examination. Starting on line one, Mr. Sathoff asks, and there's an amortization schedule that's exhibit 24, number 24, with several different amortization schedules attached to it. Do you know who created any of these amortization schedules? Barb answers, it wasn't me. It wasn't Don. Now, Don is her deceased husband, Don Humphrey. And she continues, it had to be Mr. Smith. Matthew, okay, or it could have been a family member that tracks the money. Let me cut in right there, people. As this process moves forward, you're going to find Matthew Sathoff constantly saying that I created the documents. He's using phrases like he created, he prepared, like this. Yet here, he's saying though it could have been a family member that tracks the money. A little earlier when I was questioning Bart, she says it could have been made on someone else's computer. So I wanted to point this out because as I move forward, you're going to find Matt constantly telling the court, both the district court and the Supreme Court, that I was the one that created these documents. So to move on, Barb answers, I kept track of the rental payments. This is after, okay, jump back to Matthew's first question. Okay, and exhibit number 24, have you followed and done the research to track the payment amounts according to what was received by Mr. Humphrey and you? Barb, I kept track of the rental payments that Mr. Smith made each month, but I didn't follow the amortization schedules because there were so many of them. Okay, it's what Matt said. Then Barb continued, I just figured it's going to be a five-year loan, or six-year loan. Well, we'll come to that conclusion when the time comes. That's what she was saying. So my point is that even during the depositions, they was denying things. But when it come down to submitting legal documents to the court, Matthew Sethoff himself was lying to both the district court and to the Nebraska Supreme Court because he was misrepresenting the facts. He kept saying he created, insinuating that I had created the document. He was saying he prepared, stuff like this. So we're going to leave it there and move. Ladies and gentlemen, again, if you're on video, you're probably seeing document title, annotated statement of undisputed facts in support of the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. People, the words undisputed facts means there's nothing in this document disputable. The words undisputed facts should mean something. It should mean there is absolutely no chance that there's lies involved in this document, or that there's no information in there or language in there that misrepresents the facts. What you'll find on page 3 of this document is concrete evidence, even though I've shown evidence or proof that the daughter created this document. Here we go with the lies in the district court. So on line 19 of page 3, it states, Edwards' repayment schedule was memorialized in payment schedule he prepared. What does he mean he prepared? He knows that Elizabeth Humphrey, his client's daughter, created the schedule. Now he's saying he prepared. So do you get my point? Now let's move to line 22. Same page. Page 3. Okay. So now on the line 22, he wrote, Edward admitted the purchase agreement, the warranty deed, and the amortization schedule he created are not fraudulent and lists all payments he has made towards the loan. What does he mean? Again, this is in the summary judgment, the motion for summary judgment that he's asking Judge Doherty in the Douglas County District Court to rule on. Okay? He's saying he created. What does he mean by that? Is he legitimizing Elizabeth Humphrey's fraudulent schedule by saying he created? That's exactly what he's doing, people. Now, this was a Douglas County District Court document. It was filed with the court. And the worst part was, guess what? Judge Doherty, in this case, ruled in favor of this summary judgment. Duh, can you believe that? I can. Anytime you're dealing with a courthouse that's deeply segregated, these are the type of outcomes that minorities grow to expect. So with that said, folks, we're going to move on to the brief for the appellee, Bobby J. Humphrey. Now, this brief was created and filed by Matthew Sethoff. And worse yet, this brief was heard by the top court in the state of Nebraska, the Nebraska Supreme Court. So listen to this. On page 9 of this brief, Matthew Sethoff states, now he's accusing me, even though he knows that his own client's daughter created that fraudulent schedule, he's still using language that legalizes or legitimizes what she did. This is one of the sentences that he wrote on page 9 of this brief for the appellee. Here we go. Quote, the first sentence of the appellant's statement of fact misrepresents that certain language comes from a loan agreement, but it comes from a document that the appellant Smith prepared as a loan amortization schedule and was never signed off on by the parties and attached to his deposition. How do you like that, folks? This man has no shame. How do you file a document with the highest court in this state without fear of retribution? This just makes absolutely no sense. And the only thing it points toward is that Nebraska's Jim Crow laws, which was enacted in 1865, are being practiced in this case. And that's why he has no fear. Matthew Sethoff has no fear of this coming back to bite him in the ass. Simple as that. Address 440, Regency Parkway, Omaha, Nebraska. Shame on you, Matthew Sethoff. Now, I've already shown evidence that the daughter created the document. Kevin O'Keefe was found on tape saying it. The email that Kevin O'Keefe and Matthew Sethoff exchanged stated that fact. And yet, he is still insisting that I created this document. So like I said, to the highest court in the state of Nebraska, he writes, but it comes from a document that appellant Smith prepared as a loan amortization schedule. I mean, Matthew Sethoff, give me a break. What is mentally wrong with you, man? I mean, I want to curse, but I won't. So I say this, please give me a little bit of a break, sir. Again, those of you watching video can see the plaintiff's affidavit. That was the first document she filed, and that was back on September 26th of 2018. Now, if you can see line 5, you'll see they have two options there. One is that I am the whoever of the deceased. Clearly, she's going to say the wife or spouse of the deceased, and I am entitled to the real property by reason of the homestead allowance, exempt property allowance, family allowance, and all that crap. But anyway, the second option there is the one that's checked on the original affidavit. I am entitled to the real property per the will. Now, this was the plaintiff's attorney. The attorney that filed this name was John, I think his last name is pronounced Chatelain. And this was on September 26th of 2018. Now, he knew, Ms. Chatelain knew that Nebraska law do not, if let's put it this way, if you have a will and it's unsigned, it's not enforceable. And John Chatelain knew this when he filed that document. But Ms. Chatelain didn't think that I had the means or the financial means, I should say, to fight this case. And so he moved forward because he knew that even if he was wrong, Nebraska's Jim Crow laws would protect him because these laws restrict blacks from testifying or should say they restrict blacks from being involved in any litigation against white people in a legal system. And he knew this. So he could have put, oh hell, the devil made me do it on the document. And guess what? The court would have went for it and they would have ruled in his favor. But to show you that he was wrong, the second document there is an affidavit that my own attorney tried to sabotage my case with. She wanted me to allow them to amend this document and put the first option in there. I am the spouse of the deceased. Well, guess what? How far that went? Nowhere. But the reason I started speaking about these affidavits is back to Matthew Sethoff again. And back to the brief for the appellee, Barbara J. Humphrey, that he filed that was heard by the Supreme Court. On page 6 of that document, Matthew Sethoff wrote, probate on September 25, 2018, which transferred Donald's interest in the home to her. The affidavit states, the deceased is the sole owner of the real property, described as an undivided one-half interest in lot 16, Dillard's 11th edition. A DRI title escrow report dated April 23, 2020 lists Barbara J. Humphrey and Edward J. Smith as the vested title holders in the home. Okay, guess what, people? What he put on there, what Matthew Sethoff put on there, on that brief, came from line 2. What happened to she was entitled to the property per the will? I'll tell you what happened to it. They knew that the will was unenforceable when they filed this damn thing. Okay, so even the affidavit was illegal. But Matthew Sethoff misrepresented the facts. He manipulated the system. He deceived the Nebraska Supreme Court by leaving that part out. So he used strategy to do that. Does this man have any shame whatsoever? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I done calmed down a little bit now. But we're about to move forward. I want to show you and give you positive evidence that the Jim Crow laws are being practiced in this case. But before we get to that point, I want to share something else with you. The interrogatory answers that Ms. Humphrey gave to John Chaplin, her first attorney. On number 25 of the interrogatories, John Chaplin asked Ms. Humphrey, or whoever was answering the questions, I'm absolutely certain it was Elizabeth Humphrey, because she threw her mom down on the Amtrak track rail, knowing that the damn train was heading that way. So, but anyway, John asked the questions to describe any and all discussions or communications between Edward Smith and any person regarding any loan, payment of loan, or ownership of the subject property. Whoever answered the question answered, after the house was purchased, Ed, Don, and Barb sat down and discussed repayment of the loan at the Humphreys' home. That was a lie. It never happened. The second answer was, on September 6, 2018, after Don died, Ed, Barb, and Elizabeth had a discussion. That was a lie. Okay, we did have a discussion, but it was on September 16th. Okay, so anyway, the point is that there was one meeting that had taken place. Conveniently, they forgot to mention it during this answer. So I'm going to take a quick break. I'll come back and I'll fill you in on that. Alrighty, I was back. Okay, people, now, what we're doing now is going into Ms. Humphrey's deposition. Of course, I had terminated my original attorneys because, like I said, they were sabotaging my case. So I was asking these questions. Matthew Sethoff was present. He was beside his client, Barbara Humphrey. So when I finished asking my questions, then he cross-examined her. If you'll notice, she is going to give the true answers. And then when he cross-examines her, he asks her a bunch of leading questions to lead her to sort to retract what she'd already said. At the same time, to show you that she's telling the truth. At one point, he asked her, was it true that Don was giving me the house and a car? And she corrected him and said a house and a truck. That shows that this meeting did take place, that it was still fresh in her head. But when they asked her on the interrogatory number 25 to tell them about all the times we had had meetings about the loan and all that, including ownership of the house and all that, she had lied. Okay, I won't say she lied. She withheld the information that was supposed to go on there. So anyway, I'm going to start on line 25 from her May 29th, 2020 deposition. On the line 3 of page 45, I asked a question. Now, I highlighted myself. My question's in orange and her stuff in pink. So here I go. Miss Humphrey, on the evening that we had the gathering, you do remember the gathering, right? Barbara, I don't know which gathering you're talking about. Me, okay? It's the gathering where Mr. Humphrey, you, me, and Lynn were all at your house. It was the only time that all four of us had ever sat in your living room together. Do you remember that? Barbara, just before he died, you mean? Me. This was about a month and a half before he died. This was about 2, maybe 3 weeks before you put him back in the hospital for the last time. Do you remember that, Barbara? Yes. Then we skip on to, you can probably hear the pages turning here, but we skip on to page 46. Okay, on the line 6, me. I stood there in front of you when you came out of the kitchen, and I explained to Don that I had witnessed some of the loads that he'd hauled with the old truck. Okay? I stood there and told him that $5,000, if he wanted me to continue to help you. I explained to him that $5,000 was not going to buy another truck worthy of hauling the types of loads that we'd been hauling. Am I correct, Barbara? Yes, because I think he thought the same thing. So if the two of you exchanged those ideas, he pretty much thought the same thing. But me, I'm getting to a point here, okay? When I explained that to him, the first thing he said was, we can afford to go up to 10. Am I correct, Barbara? Yes. Now, we're talking about money values, okay? $5,000, $10,000. Barbara, yes. Me, and it angered you. Barbara, yes. The first words out of your mouth was, oh, so he's got the house. He's got the house. And he's getting a new truck. And with that, you jumped up. You ran out of the front door. Am I correct? Then Matthew Sathoff jumped in and said, listen to his question and answer his question. Then, Barbara, I was upset at that statement. Yes, I went out of the front door. Me, you went out of the house. Barbara, I went out of the house. Yes. And then Lynn followed you out. Barbara, yes. Okay. Now, here goes your cross-examination. This is Matthew Sathoff questioning his client. Matthew, did you ever make the statement, so he has a house and a car, yes or no? Barbara, house and a truck. She corrected him. Matt, house and a truck. Barbara, yes. Matt, okay. And what did you mean by that? Barbara, well, Don wanted to give him the house, the $25,000 he put up front for the house, and then the $10,000 went toward a truck. Okay, so then we jump to page 81. Matt, now he's asking leading questions. So when you made that statement, so he has a house and a truck, that didn't mean he had the house free and clear. Barbara, correct. Matt, he still owed the money on it. Barbara, he still owes the money towards the house. Okay, now you get a point. The point is the Supreme Court was concerned about ownership of the property. Clearly, this shows evidence that the loan was forgiven. Only because Matt led her to backtrack on what she was saying was the reason that she tried to wiggle out of it. But my point is that the loan was forgiven. Barbara was present when Dunn forgave the loan. We were all in their living room. And when John Chatelain asked her in under interrogatory number 25 about any meetings we had, she deliberately, intentionally left that meeting out. But listening to this deposition, it's clear that she had not forgotten. Anyway, folks, you already know that Matt Sethoff filed his motion for summary judgment on behalf of his client. But when the judge gave his order on the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, I want to take time and give you a brief on exactly what he ruled on. Now, on page 5, as you can see on this order, on analysis, the judge wrote, he wrote it like this. However, since Smith provided evidence that the loan was forgiven, the court cannot find as a matter of law that Barbara is entitled to the remainder of this balance owed. Okay, folks, now right there, the judge cut off, and he's saying that Barbara was not entitled to the remainder of the balance owed because I had shown him evidence that the loan had been forgiven. Now, keep this in mind also. This entire lawsuit is based on them filing that amortization schedule, the fraudulent one, saying that I still owed the loan. And that was the only reason that they was trying to force me to sell my house in order to repay them that loan. Now there, the judge is saying that I had shown him evidence that the loan had been forgiven. Okay, now we move on to page 6 of this same order. At the bottom of page 6, the judge says, a reasonable mind could conclude that although Smith initially agreed to repay the loan in full, it was later forgiven and that Smith is no longer obligated to repay it. So there again, he's saying that the loan is forgiven, following up with me showing evidence that the loan was forgiven. Okay, so now I'm no longer obligated to pay it. But then he turns around on page 10 and says this, accordingly, Barbara's request for the appointment of a referee will be granted. What kind of crap is that? I mean, you're saying that the loan, you agree that the loan was forgiven, but you're still appointing a referee to force the sale of my property. What kind of crap is that? Okay, that's showing me that the judge misunderstood what he was doing, or more plausible is that Matthew Sethoff's writing, his submissions to the court, were so confusing and written in a manner that the judge misunderstood what these documents were saying. Okay, so he was basically just following Matthew Sethoff's lead. And that's why he's saying, okay, well, the loan's forgiven. I agree with that. Mr. Smith has shown evidence with this, but Barbara can still force the sale of his house. So I'm appointing this referee to, you know, to oversee the sale of the property. What kind of crap is this? Okay, so I don't blame the judge for this. Do not get me wrong. I blame Matthew Sethoff because he has lied. He has submitted facts that are disputed, even though his summary judgment said that he was submitting undisputed facts. It was just a bald-faced lie. But keep this in mind also. I did appeal this. this ruling. But by the time my attorneys got to Lincoln, to the Supreme Court, those documents that he had lied on again, constantly saying that I had created your amortization schedule, was there ahead of me. But the Supreme Court saw this case the way it should have been ruled, and they reversed what the lower court did. So we'll come up on that next. Can a lawyer be charged with assisting their clients with fraud? Lawyers are not permitted to assist or further crimes or frauds committed by their clients. If a lawyer does so, provided that no one else finds out about it, it would disembowel the lawyer-client privilege and expose both the lawyer and their client to civil and criminal actions. This is uncontroversial. But what about the lawyer who is aware of his client's fraud, but has done nothing to assist or further it? Let's assume further that the fraud is an ongoing matter and not something from the past. What is the lawyer's duty or professional responsibilities, especially considering that the lawyers aren't supposed to disclose a client's confidences or privileged communications without the client's consent? Although a couple of states do make it mandatory that lawyers prevent continuing fraud by a client, some laws require that a lawyer reveal information related to the representation of a client that the lawyer himself or herself believes is necessary to prevent the client from committing a criminal or fraudulent act, an act where the lawyer believes their client's actions are likely to result in someone's death or bodily harm or even substantial injury to the financial interests or property of someone else. So, ladies and gentlemen, in Dora and my case, do any of you listening believe that the plaintiff's lawyers are guilty of assisting or furthering crimes of fraud committed by their clients? I mean, although the Nebraska Supreme Court gave its opinion on this case isn't over, folks, not by a long shot. And the evidence coming up in episode 2 will blow you away. Not only will I revisit issues that I didn't get a chance to get back to here in episode 1, my further plans are to shock and awe. So don't miss out. Subscribe, click the bell, and I'll notify you of every new episode coming out. Until next time, this is Sniffer signing out. Copy that.